Happy Earth Day, everybody. You have all signed on to the Clue-In Internet session on green remediation, and we're very excited to be kicking this series off. This will be the first, hopefully, in a series of sessions that we're going to have on specific projects and approaches, sustainable approaches, in land revitalization and land cleanup. So we're very excited to kick this off. I want to give you a few reminders. Well, first of all, I'll introduce myself. I'm Sarah Rasmussen. I'm a senior analyst in the Office of Solid Waste, United States Environmental Protection Agency, and I'm going to be giving the introduction to this session today. A few reminders we have is if you have the ability, please put your phone on mute. If you don't, you can always press *6, and that will put your phone on mute. We also ask that you do not put your phone on hold, as some companies put music or other audio for their holds, and that interferes with the conference call. For those of you who are on streaming audio today, and at this point I believe we have about 100 different telephone lines patched in, as well as 100 different options for audio, streaming audio, you are welcome to type in questions as we go. We will be monitoring the questions. They will show up here. You can type those questions in by looking at the top part of your screen. As a part of the buttons up there, just press question, and you can type in your question. We will be having question and answers after each speaker for a short period of time, and then we'll have more extended question and answer period at the end. I've also gotten several inquiries as to whether this seminar will be archived. It will be archived, and so you'll be able to go back later and both pull up the slides we have today, as well as hear the audio. I hear people still coming on the line, so again, I will say Happy Earth Day, and welcome to the Green Approaches and the Land Revitalization Process, or the Green Remediation Panel that we're doing today. Again, I will say we hope this is the first in a series of sessions that we put on sustainable activities in cleanup and land revitalization. And I will warn you that I'm going to come in back at the end of this session, and I'm going to ask you which topics you would like to see in future sessions. We really want this to be a useful and educational series, so we'd like to know what you'd like to hear about. Okay, the reason why we're putting these sessions on is that sustainability has become such a key concept today. And we're getting a lot of questions from the land revitalization cleanup community. What would a sustainable cleanup look like? What are activities I can do to make my cleanup or my land revitalization more sustainable? What is EPA's focus? If you move to page 2, I've put down some of EPA's strategic objectives and action plans. You'll notice that the EPA strategic plan 2006-2011 lists that EPA's cleanup programs have set a national goal of returning formerly contaminated sites to long-term, sustainable, and productive use. And I think that basically sums up what we need to know there. I also have listed some of the EPA's action plans and the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response action plan items. A lot of people want to know what sustainable is, and if you Google sustainable, you will come up with 100 different definitions. I included here a definition from the Executive Order 13423 from January 26, 2007, which says, sustainable means to create and maintain conditions under which humans and nature can exist in productive harmony that permit fulfilling the social, economic, and other requirements of present and future generations. Please go to slide 4. The definitions that we've tried to come up with in our cleanup programs is a little bit more specific, and what we've come up with is: sustainable revitalization is a holistic approach to the cleanup of revitalization of a property. It considers a broad array of environmental factors and community impacts during all phases of a cleanup and land revitalization, and that would be demolition, waste remediation, design, construction, and reuse. in order to maximize the environmental, the social, and the economic benefits associated with the project. One of the interesting situations that we have at EPA is that we have several different programs and several different projects going on. And if you were to look at EPA's strategic plan, you'll see that our goal one is for clean air, goal two is for clean and safe water, goal three is for land preservation and restoration, goal four is for healthy communities and ecosystems, goal five is compliance and environmental stewardship, and so it goes on. So what we have is we have a lot of interesting activities going on around the agency. To help us get a better understanding of what all is going on and what are resources that we can be using and thinking about in our cleanup and revitalization projects, we brought together a series of EPA people, and we spent some time trying to look at what are some of the approaches that one could take in a land revitalization process that would help green it or make it more sustainable. And what is the framework that we can use to help convey these to people so we can have a common framework or a common discussion point? If you move to slide four, you'll see the beginning of this framework. And basically, we were looking at land cleanup and revitalization projects in four phases. The first phase is deconstruction and demolition and removal. And there's a lot of opportunity there for waste minimization, resource recovery and recycling. The second phase is cleanup, remediation, and waste management. And there are a lot of activities that can be done to make a remediation activity potentially more environmentally friendly. The third phase is the design and construction of a new use. And there are a lot of things that can be worked into a design in the way of working with the landscaping, working with the design of the buildings and structures so that they're more environmentally friendly, designing the actual development so that it's more sustainable and more healthy for the community. And then the last bullet is sustainable and long-term stewardship. And that is, what are we doing in our follow-on use to be more environmentally friendly, to be more sustainable? And what type of long-term stewardship is going on if there is any waste left in place? So our motto at this point is to look for opportunities throughout the entire revitalization process. If you move on to page five, we've listed some of the opportunities that can be looked at for a land revitalization and cleanup project. Many of the cleanup projects are individualistic, so not all of these are going to apply to every single project. But here are some examples of items that you can look at. For instance, recycle and reuse deconstruction and demolition materials. Reuse materials on site. We're finding that certainly you can crush concrete and a lot of other things so that you don't have the transportation and the disposal costs. Consider the future use of a site and use existing infrastructure where it's possible. And that includes preserving and reusing historic buildings. You'll see throughout the entire process a focus on using clean diesel and low sulfur fuels, as well as alternate fuels for any type of activity that you have that requires power. Retain native and vegetation and soils whenever possible, and to protect water resources from runoff and contamination. If you were to look at the second bubble, which is cleanup, remediation, waste management, that also includes looking at the fuels you use and working to use clean fuels or alternate energy fuels, using renewable energy sources, improving energy efficiency in remediation strategies, selecting remediation approaches such as phytoremediation that reduce resource use, the impact on air, water, and adjacent lands and public health. It also includes employing remediation practices that can restore soil health and ecosystems back to better health, and in some cases sequester carbon through soil amendments and vegetation. Carlos Pichon is going to be speaking more about these topics today, as is Michelle Mahoney.
Excuse me.
Yes?
I am trying to get the site where you're giving all that information at, and I can't locate it.
Did you register?
Yes. Did you register for the seminar?
I thought I did.
Have you seen the name of the gentleman? Jean Ballett.
You should have received an email from Jean Ballett, which gave you the information on how to...
Yeah, I did. I wrote it all down, but it, for some reason, I am not getting it.
Okay.
I want to try one more time.
Please call this
number. Can you please call this number then?
Okay.
We go 1-309-5318. I'll repeat that. 301-589-5318.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, and I'll call right back then. Thank you.
Some ideas and approaches that can be taken, and the third bubble here, which is design and construction for reuse, include using approaches that reduce resource use, such as Energy Star, LEED, Greenscapes, principles. That includes the green buildings and several other activities to make sure that the structures you design and the landscaping you design are more sustainable and require fewer resources to maintain. It includes reducing the environmental impact by using existing structures and recycling industrial materials as you do your construction. It includes incorporating natural systems to manage stormwater, such as green roofs, landscape swales, and wetlands. Possibilities also include smart growth principles that promote more balanced land uses and walkable neighborhoods, and ecological enhancements to promote biodiversity and improve wildlife habitat. The last bubble is sustainable use and long-term stewardship, and this is focusing on the new use to reduce toxics and materials, to reduce waste generation, to recycle materials when possible, to maintain the engineering and institutional controls if there's waste left on site, to reduce water use by incorporating water-efficient systems and native vegetation to limit irrigation, maximizing energy efficiency and increase the use of renewable energy, and to take appropriate steps to avoid decontamination. If you move to page 7, you'll see some benefits that could be achieved by adopting some of these approaches. And we've now moved into an era where actually using several of these approaches are more cost-effective than not. For instance, we've had fantastic success with recycling demolition waste. We're having projects that have managed to recycle over 90% of their demolition waste and have saved hundreds of thousands of dollars in their cleanup from avoided transportation and disposal costs. If you reduce the amount of energy you use, obviously you're also going to be reducing the cost. So there's a variety of economic benefits, social benefits, and environmental benefits which could occur when you take these approaches. I'm not going to read them all here, and these are just examples. If you look in the center of this page, you'll see three bubbles. One's labeled economic, one's labeled environmental, and one is labeled social. Here at EPA, we focus on managing the environmental impacts of activities. But if you were to look for what would be a sustainable activity, hopefully that would be one that manages environmental impacts, social impacts, and economic impacts in a way so that it's sustainable in those three contexts beyond just environmental. Okay, I'm going to move on then to page 7. We have a great panel coming up, and I don't want to take too much time. So I'm going to tell you that there's a lot of information we have on EPA websites. I've listed many of them here. You will find that these websites are going to have more and more information on sustainable approaches, so please check back to them as much as you can. And again, I want to remind you that I will be asking you at the end of this session for additional topics you'd like to hear about. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Kathy Allen, who is going to be the moderator of today's session. She's a team leader for the Climate Change and Contaminated Lands Work Group, and the speakers are talking about projects that are being conducted in relation to that work group.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. It's a great way to spend Earth Day. My name is Kathy Allen, and I work at EPA's Clean Up Contaminated Land Program, and I have the great pleasure of co-chairing this working group as looking specifically at our programs that clean up and revitalize lands and some of the intersections with greenhouse gas emissions. So this is a narrower range of issues than the entire sustainable revitalization that Sarah was just talking about, and that's why we're hoping to have and will have additional sessions on this in the future. So I would just like to reiterate what Sarah said, that if you guys are interested in specific topics, if ideas come up during this session, please send those along to us, and I will tell you how to do that in a minute. I just want to remind everybody who's joined recently to please put your phone on mute. Please don't put us on hold because we don't want to listen to any great symphonies while our speakers are talking. There is a way to submit questions. We won't be asking verbal questions, but if you look at the top of your slide, look at slide 8, you'll see that there's a question mark, a blue question mark with a circle around it. And if you hit that, you can write in a question, and within 30 seconds or so, it comes to me, and I'll be checking in every now and then on those questions. And after each panelist talks for 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so, I'll check the questions, and I'll read the questions out so you all can hear them, and we'll get answers. And then at the end of the panel again, we'll also go through additional questions. So please feel free to submit questions in that way. If you have technical issues while we're moving forward with this as well, you can submit those to me as a question, and I'll get those forwarded to the right people, because I know sometimes there are some technical issues. So with that, we'll get started. I'm really thrilled that today we have Carlos Pachon, Penelope McDaniel, and Michelle Mahoney talking to us. There are three project leads or co-leads. The bios are all attached, and you can look at those directly. So I'll introduce them one by one. And first, we're going to hear from Carlos. And I'd like to thank Carlos for this session. He was very instrumental in setting it up, so thank you, Carlos. And Carlos is in our Office of Superfund Remediation and Technical Innovation and has been doing a lot of work and showing a lot of leadership in the area of green remediation. And with that, I'll turn it over to Carlos. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy, and good morning, everybody, at least for those of you on the East Coast. I think we should currently be on slide, on the website, if you can click ahead, we should be on slide 9 of this. All the presentations have been strung together, and right now we are on slide 9. So, again, good morning. My name is Carlos Pachon. I'm a Senior Program Analyst here with the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and it's a pleasure to be a part of this panel and to be able to share some information and some insight, and particularly to hear from you. Hopefully the conversation will be active. We have budgeted some time to speak about these topics with all of you. As you have heard from both Sarah and Kathy, a green remediation is one phase in what can be called a sustainability continuum for contaminated site cleanup and redevelopment. In this presentation and in the green remediation primer, which I'll discuss briefly and which EPA has released today, we'll generally focus on opportunities to reduce the environmental footprint of a cleanup during remedy implementation. Hence, in slide 2, we have developed a term or a definition, a working definition, of what we consider to be green remediation, and that is the practice of considering the environmental effects of a remediation strategy, that is, remedy selected, and the implementation approach early in the process and incorporating options to maximize the net environmental benefit of the cleanup action. We can go to slide number 11, please. Looking at green remediation and sustainable practices for site remediation as the bigger picture, works best if we look at things from a whole site approach. It's important to step out of the box and look around at how decisions made during the remedy implementation during the cleanup phase affect and are affected by those by others. Look, for example, upstream at some of the decisions that have been made or that will be made if you are looking at a very early phase, such as Sarah described earlier, the construction and demolition phase. What is there about that, those activities that can impact or be affected by the remedy, and how can those decisions work together so that in a whole site approach we're making more sustainable decisions? And the same applies looking downstream. what is the footprint of the site reuse, and how can that footprint influence or inform cleanup decisions. So again, that's a really holistic look at it, and hopefully we'll get into, well, not hopefully, we will be getting into some more detail to the extent that time permits in this session. So again, sustainable practices for site remediation, certainly consider all the environmental effects of remedy implementation, incorporates options to maximize the net environmental benefit of cleanup actions. We're seeking to minimize the quote-unquote footprints on air, water, soil, and ecology. And as we've heard, we'll seek to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to climate change. And excuse that typo, I forgot the right change in there. If we could go to slide 12, please. So as we have been saying here, EPA is working internally and jointly across programs, both at headquarters and in the regions. Cleanup programs such as SARAS, the Resource Conservation Recovery Act Corrective Action, the Superfund, the program I am in, the Brownfields, and other programs. We're working as well with states and other federal agencies. In fact, we'll be going to the Association of State and Territorial Solid Waste Management officials meeting next week, the ITRC, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and others, in what we hope is a joint effort to identify opportunities to implement green remediation across all programs. This is not a program-specific effort. There are core elements. The reason for this is that there are core elements to a green remediation shared by all cleanup programs, regardless of the regulatory framework. We'll represent these in this little circle you have, which identifies some of the core elements of green remediation, and we'll be discussing these in a little bit more detail, but as you can see, they include energy considerations, air, water resources, land and ecosystems, materials and waste, and long-term stewardship. All of these core elements are affected in some way or another in a site cleanup process. Not all of them necessarily, but quite often at any cleanup, site cleanup project, we will be impacting and have an opportunity to consider one of these core elements. If we could go to slide 13, please. Regarding current practices, we've come a long way from the days of Luck Canal and the Valley of Drums, the early days in site cleanups, when we were tackling new environmental problems for the first time and we struggled to identify technical solutions to deal with the legacy of contaminated sites. Thanks to effective regulatory programs, creative solutions on the part of technology developers, and innovative practitioners, we now have a good suite of viable, off-the-shelf solutions that are being used over and over. The next challenge in site cleanup is to continue improving the quality and the benefit of the work by minimizing the environmental footprint during the implementation of these cleanup options we have developed. Many of the practices are already out there. This effort is really not rocket technology. This is an effort to identify what best practices are already out there and sharing that knowledge with practitioners, with remedy, with site managers and stakeholders across all these cleanup programs. And these include, as you've heard, increasing the energy efficiency of treatment systems, conserving water resources, improving water quality and minimizing water quality impacts, managing and minimizing toxics and waste, and reducing emission criteria of air pollutants and greenhouse gases. So we could go to slide 14. I'm going to go into some of those core elements I discussed earlier in that circle. We'll start off with energy requirements. And a note here that as part of the green remediation primer that has been released today, EPA is also conducting an ongoing analysis of the energy and carbon footprint of Superfund cleanups. Through that analysis, we've concluded so far that through 2030, the top five treatment technologies used at NPL, National Priority List sites, will require about $1.3 billion just to operate them. So we're not looking, in energy requirements, we're not looking for technologies that we can take offline because they are energy intensive. we are looking for opportunities to reduce the footprints, energy and carbon footprints, of those and all other technologies. Examples of how to do this include can include periodic evaluation and optimization of the equipment with high energy demand. And we already have several programs in Superfund, certainly, to do that. But we believe there are great opportunities to expand the knowledge that has been obtained and share it with other decision makers. We're also looking very extensively at the use of renewable energy systems to replace or offset grid electricity that is powering some of these treatment systems. And we'll hear a little bit more about that now and also as well as from some of the other speakers on the panel, particularly Penelope McDaniel. We could go to slide 15, please. Regarding air emissions, contaminated sites are often located near or in urban areas and require the use of heavy equipment, often known as yellow iron, or smaller internal combustion engines that power accessory equipment or treatment systems. In EPA's Region 9, for example, they are tackling this issue head-on with their clean air cleanup effort, which is identifying opportunities to reduce the impact on air quality near site cleanup projects. Examples of what you're doing, and which are defined more extensively in the primer and at the website that they have developed, and all of that information is available in the primer. Examples include the optimal and proper maintenance of heavy equipment used in the construction and operation of a treatment system, the use of cleaner fuel and retrofit diesel engines for such equipment. Another good example, and many opportunities are out there, to modify operations to reduce operating and idle time of all internal combustion engine equipment being used on the site. And naturally, common practice is minimizing dust and the possible export of contaminants that may be associated with that dust. We could go to slide 16, please. Local, state, and federal regulations already protect water resources in the U.S., but as is the case with air, site cleanup activities can still have detrimental effect on water resources. Examples may be excessive drawdowns of groundwater or nutrient loading of surface waters. These are just two examples of how we can have a detrimental impact on water resources. The core elements of green remediation in the case of water seek to minimize these impacts and again get the greatest net benefit out of the cleanup efforts and investments at a site. Examples of some of these activities can include minimum freshwater use and maximum reuse during treatment and site operations, the use of reclaimed treated water, or to use an aquifer storage, looking at site reuse, using native vegetation, which has little or no irrigation requirements, and actually, as I mentioned earlier, the prevention of water quality impacts, such as nutrient loading, sediment runoff, turbidity, et cetera, from site activities that might impact nearby surface water bodies. If we could go to slide 17. In urban areas, adjacent to high-value wildlife areas or corridors, and in suburban or rural areas, there are opportunities not only to protect ecosystems, but to enhance their richness and functionality, altering site cleanup and after site activities diminish and we pull out of the site. Examples of how we can do this is the use of minimally invasive in situ technologies which will not affect the surface. Coupling passive energy technologies as either primary remedies or finishing steps to the extent possible. Minimizing soil and habitat disturbance. By soil disturbance, it's, for example, the use of heavy equipment that can compact soil, thereby minimizing water infiltration, air pockets, making the regeneration of the ecosystem on the site more difficult. Adopt eco-restoration and reuse practices, and EPA has put out quite a few bulletins, and there's actually a website on eco-restoration of contaminated sites, which is also listed in the Green Remediation Primer. So there's a lot of knowledge that has already been developed there. In this presentation, I'm just highlighting some of the areas of core elements of green remediation and the opportunity to reduce noise and light disturbance from cleanup activities. If we could go to slide 18, please. We heard at the beginning of the presentation from Sarah some discussion on material consumption and waste generation. Internally, it is one of the topics that we discussed as a possible future internet seminar. We welcome your thoughts on that. There is definitely a lot of information out there, a lot that can be shared, a lot of lessons learned. So we welcome your feedback on that. But again, if I can just highlight some of the opportunities here. The use of technologies, opportunities that can reduce material consumption and waste generation. So one of them might be the technologies, the use of technologies designed to minimize waste generation. Again, this goes back, for example, to the concept of in-situ treatment technologies versus dig-and-haul approaches that may result in large amounts of contaminated soil to be managed. Another is the reuse and recycling of materials, including construction and demolition debris. I have one example, one case study on that, but again, there are many creative ways of minimizing the generation of construction demolition debris and maximizing its reuse either on-site or off-site. And I'll summarize in that the primer goes into a lot of detail on some of these other examples that we have posted up here. And again, I'll bring up some specific examples with the intent of staying on time with some of the case studies. Okay, so we could go to slide 17.
19.
Oh, excuse me, 19. I need glasses. Long-term stewardship. Long-term stewardship may not always be a priority goal going into a site cleanup, but decisions made at that point in that phase of a site cleanup and reuse can certainly adopt sustainable stewardship practices and foster their adoption by downstream decision makers. Understanding what decisions are being made downstream and using that information for cleanup decisions can foster better the adoption of more long-term sustainable stewardship activities. We mentioned reduced emission of CO2, of methane, and other greenhouse gases, both in the remedy implementation and in their link-up with the post-cleanup phases and reuse. The use of adaptive management approaches integrated into long-term actions and redevelopment, similar concept. The adoption of renewable energy systems for long-term cleanup and future economic benefit. That's one of the areas that we're looking at is looking at sharing the capital cost of renewable energy investment so that it's spread out not only for powering the cleanup, but those systems can remain on site and be used for the post-cleanup site reuse. Examples are, of course, photovoltaic farms, wind power, or combined heat and power systems that can be used to power both the treatment system and to optimize its functionality, as well as to support post-cleanup activities at the site. And then, as we suggested earlier, looking downstream at post-cleanup decisions and site reuse, how can infrastructure built for the remedy be leveraged for the reuse? I have a couple of case studies I'd like to talk to you about. The first one is in passive energy. This is Fredula Landfill. It's a site, a landfill site in Frankfort, New York. This system has been in operation for 10 years. So again, a lot of this is not necessarily cutting edge technology. It's just smart decisions made at the right place at the right time. The system was approved by the New York State DEC. And basically, wind power replaces electrical power as part of a solar vapor extraction system on a 1.8-acre landfill. The way it works is that the windmill powers a 10-inch air cylinder, and each intake of the stroke of the cylinder draws a vacuum from the landfill vents. The exhaust stroke then pushes that air, of course there's a valve system to control it, and the exhaust stroke pushes the air through a carbon canister to treat it before it is released. We can go to slide 21. We have another example, and this is a green radiation profile at a site in Monterey Park, California. This is a landfill site with six 70-kilowatt microturbines that are powered from the landfill collection system at 5,500 standard cubic feet per minute. We're currently looking at systems such as this one so that to determine how they can be coupled to the treatment system so that the heat from a combined heat and power system can be used to optimize the treatment component while the gas from the landfill or another renewable source actually powers the systems. We could go to the next slide, slide 22, please. Another example, and this profile is written up on the Green Remediation website, which I'll give you the URL shortly. At this site, photovoltaic panels are generating electricity for a fluid gathering system during an oil recovery at a cleanup project. This is Resource Conservation Recovery Act corrective action site, and the reclaimed oil is used for refinery feedstock. At the same time, a wind-driven turbine, compressors, and electric generators power the pumps to recover the free oil products. This case study is written up in more detail at the Green Remediation website. I'm going to skip ahead to slide 23. I'm running a little bit short on time here, and I'd like to leave time for our discussion. I just wanted to highlight at a Superfund site in Leadville, Colorado. This is a California Gulch. Slide
24.
We're currently on slide 24. It's just the one final green remediation profile. And again, this is a Superfund site in Leadville, Colorado, where they used consolidated slag to construct a recreational trail, which was then covered by gravel and asphalt. With this, they avoided invasive excavation and costly off-site disposal of the metals contaminated soil while still offering the required protectiveness and to reduce the need for imported material through the use of waste in place. As you can see in the image, this approach also fostered community end use at that site. We could go to slide 25. Briefly summarize what else we're doing to advance green remediation best practices in here at EPA. We're certainly continuing to document the state-of-the-art best management practices. That is one of the primary purposes of the green remediation primer. We're also writing up profiles and case studies, which we're posting and will continue to post on the green remediation webpage, which we'll get to in a second. We continue to identify emerging opportunities to implement these best practices. And we're developing mechanisms and tools to put them in place, such as pilot projects for renewable energy, standard contract language for cleanups, and that's quite an internal tool, and in other resources. Finally, I've been talking about the Green Remediation Primer. I should have put this up front. I wasn't sure we would beat the deadline. I'm fortunate to say that we did. And we're able to release the primer titled Green Remediation, Incorporating Sustainable Environmental Practices into the Remediation of Contaminated Sites. This document is available at cluin.org/green-remediation. And again, it's released in this month. It is a free document. And if you go to the next slide, you have the URL where you can download it. It is cluin.org/green-remediation. We will continue to build this website. Feedback is strongly encouraged both on this presentation, on the primer, and on the content of the website, and we hope to be able to act on it. And with that, I'll hand it back to Kathy. Thank you so much for your interest, and appreciate it.
Thank you, Carlos, and congratulations for making the Earth Day deadline on the new primer. That's really great. Carlos has been working very hard on that. I am now going to read some of the questions that we have received from you all. We'll do about 5 minutes of questions now, so I don't know if I'll get through them all, and then we'll do some more at the end. And for if anybody joined late, there's a question mark symbol at the top of your slide page, and you can submit questions to me in writing in that way. So question number one is, and please accept my apologies when I mispronounce your name. I'll do my best. But question number one is from James Schutz in New York, Buffalo, New York. And his question is, does Region 3, that's the Philadelphia office of EPA, promulgate or consider carbon footprint analysis or green remediation as a criterion in evaluating remediation alternatives? And Sarah Rasmussen will answer that question.
That's a good question, and I suspect that came from somebody seeing a presentation from Deb Goldblum or one of the other Region 3 people who are working on a individual pilot. They are looking at the footprint and other aspects of remediation options at one particular site. They're doing that to pilot methodologies for looking at the different options and evaluating the different outcomes. So at this point, I would say that they're not doing that holistically across the board, but they are working on one specific project, one pilot, where they're looking at some of that.
And if I can expand on that, I think the project that the Region 3 is working on is a RCRA corrective action site. It's not an MPL site. And there is a little bit more flexibility, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the RCRA remedy selection criteria.
Yes, they still, though, the remedies must meet the primary thresholds. They still have to be protective of human health and the environment and that type of thing.
Thank you. Carlos, can you please define yellow iron?
Yeah, I'm sorry to put that out there. It's just a term that I've been using a lot when working with a Corps of Engineers and defining the best practices. I don't know, Penny, do you guys use it in Region 9?
Oh, sometimes, yes, we do. We do.
But yeah, it generally refers to heavy equipment.
Thanks, Carlos. Okay, the next question is from Dorothy Allen of the Massachusetts DEP, and it says, in absence of regulatory provisions that require sustainability during cleanups, how does EPA suggest that the green provisions be implemented by PRPs? I'll open that up to the panel.
In the primer, and I'm sorry you weren't able to see this, and hi, Dorothy, it's good to hear from you again. The primer, which goes out today, does go into a certain detail in the first two chapters to define where EPA's policy and strategy fall in relation to green remediation. So there's no change in policy. There's ample flexibility and room within existing policy and the strategy that EPA has identified to incorporate renewable practices. As far as the PRP, as you will see, it's all voluntary. It's all a matter of maximizing the benefit of the work that's being done anyway.
If I could add to that, coming from the RCRA program, we do have people asking us, what can we be doing to make our cleanups more sustainable? So I think the responsible party or the owner-operator, some of them are already motivated to go in that direction. So it's our job to at least provide the information that we have to help them get there.
Okay, this is Kathy. We have a question and a comment that I think answers the question. So from Carl DuPol, he asks, how does green remediation tie into the LEED program and the U.S. Green Building Council? And then there's a comment from Greg Janiak from Western Solutions in Pennsylvania that says, on many projects, if you can demonstrate and document a gradient within 85% reuse during demo, you get LEED credits applicable to the new building or facility construction. So one of you has already answered another of your questions, and I don't know if other people on the panel are familiar with these intersections or not.
If I can mention that one of the reasons we started working down this path is that we did have some conversations with EPA's Brownfields program, did actually, with the Clean Buildings Council, And there was an interest in their developing a brownfields criteria, how sustainable cleanup practices could be factored in. The first step to doing that would be to identify what green cleanup practices are, and that's where we are right now. I can't say more than that, I guess.
Okay, we'll do about two more questions, and then we'll do some more at the end. But the next question is, how does one deal with invasive species in the green remediation activities? Michelle?
Actually, this was one of the questions that was being asked by a lot of site managers, I guess, when Ellen Rubin, who also works in our office, was developing some fact sheets related to ecological land reuse. So we do actually have a whole fact sheet entitled Ecological Revitalization and Attractive Nuisance Issues. And really what the whole focus is having a proper maintenance and monitoring plan at your site and determining what your invasive species is and then finding the proper way of removing them so they don't get out of control. But I would recommend that you review our fact sheet, of which I will give the link to when I do my presentation.
Okay, thanks, Michelle. Another question from Portland, Maine, from Sarah Wright, is how do you balance human health risks in PEG to the negative 6 to greenhouse gas emissions? Carlos.
I'm not sure. I think that if I understand it right, that question is looking at more on the remedy selection side. So as I said from the offset, what we're assuming here is that a remedy that is selected to clean up the site is providing the necessary protectiveness. And what we're looking at is what practices are available to reduce the environmental impact of that remedy. And I think there are many opportunities to do that. And as you suggested, carbon is possibly one of them. The carbon energy footprint, we don't know what direction public policy is going to go in this country, but I think we all agree that we need to understand what our carbon footprint is so we can identify opportunities to address it. And that's the phase we're in now. Thank you.
Okay, one more question. Are you able to cite some specific examples of public and private partnerships involving green remediation?
Green remediation is a fairly new concept, so you're not going to find long-term institutional partnerships at this point. But working on sustainability and working on specific aspects, you'll find many partnerships. We've talked about Energy Star, we've talked about green buildings, we've talked about green landscapes. Those are three programs that have been around for quite some time and are fairly well established. You'll be finding that many of the associations, for instance, our state and territorial solid waste management association has started a sustainability subcommittee. You'll find that some of the other associations out there have, and we are working with them to look at where the nexus is between our remediation activities and our land revitalization activities and the work that they do. So actually, there are many partnerships out there that are working, but I would probably say that most of them are on specific aspects of revitalization and remediation as opposed to one big broad spectrum. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing these sessions, is because it's green remediation or green revitalization in of itself is not just one concept. It's basically a basket of many, many concepts and tools put together.
And the green, this is Carlos, the green remediation parameter has several profiles, and lots of those projects could only have taken place through partnerships between the site owner, the practitioner, the company putting the remedy in place, and state regulators or federal regulators. Penny, is there?
And just to add on to that, and to echo what Sarah and Carlos have said, many of these public-private partnerships are on much smaller scale site-specific activities, and I'll be touching on at least one of those in my presentation when I talk about some of the examples. So yeah, there's a lot going on for sure, and we're doing this to try to also see what other partnerships can be developed, either be on a site-specific basis or on a larger scale.
I just want to add one more addendum to that. The EPA, Office of Enforcement, has a program called Environmentally Responsible Reuse and Redevelopment, which is referred to as ER3. And that's, in essence, a pilot program where they will partner with a responsible party or owner-operator or a developer that's wanting to revitalize a piece of property, clean up and revitalize it, and work with them to make it a sustainable project. And oftentimes when they're doing their projects, you'll find that they're partnering with the community and with the local governments and all sorts of other people, including universities, et cetera.
Okay, this is Kathy, and I'm actually going to do one more question because there are only two left, and one is from Brooke Bonkowski in Oregon, and it's a similar question from B. Hall in Utah. And the questions are asking, how do we include sustainability in the feasibility study process for evaluating alternatives? And our panelists have touched on this a little bit in regard to the Region 3 pilot, but I just would like to ask them to respond to that as well.
I think at this point we're in the process of developing methodologies for doing that. Again, our primary criteria remain protecting human health and the environment, but we're certainly encouraging people to look at these other aspects. We'll be developing more and more information on that as we go along. Some of the obvious activities are to use the tools that you can find to at least identify what your impacts are, identify what the carbon imprint or footprint would be, to identify what you believe the energy use would be for hauling a bunch of stuff off-site, to identify the energy use of particular processes and the water use of particular processes.
Okay, thank you, panelists, and thank you all for the questions. We're now going to go to the next presentation. And this will be given by Penny McDaniel. She's actually from our San Francisco office and is currently working with us out in headquarters on a number of these projects. And you should be on slide 28, and her topic is clean and renewable energy on contaminated land. Penny?
Okay. Thank you, Kathy. And I'm happy to be here to talk about, really, this is, I feel, a more specific, focused area of green remediation and revitalization, and that is citing renewable energies on renewable and clean energies on contaminated lands. So this is going to be, I think, a little more focused site-specific type of activities. So next slide, slide 29, please. I'm going to go through a project we're working on, and that is mapping out the potential renewable energy development on federally tracked contaminated lands throughout the country. And the first thing is, you may ask, is why are we looking at screening renewable energies on contaminated lands? And one component of this is that we have millions of acres of federally tracked contaminated lands. I think the most recent estimate was around 17 million acres of land. About 80%, I'll get into this a little bit more, but about 80% of that land lies outside of developed areas, so they're more remote, non-urban areas. We have embarked upon this also to really define the total potential, and I just want to add a point about this mapping effort that it is geared towards that high-level screening to show what is the total potential, not what is possible at any given site. And taking off of that, this is a tool for interested parties, whether it be developers of renewable energy, whether it be, you know, site managers at the state or federal level, you know, consultants, what have you. This is a tool that can be used for beginning that search for sites and looking at possible renewable energy development on these federally tracked contaminated lands. And the next slide, please. So just to start off, just to give you an overview here of the criteria, the types of renewable energy that energies that we looked at and the screening criteria that we used to develop these maps. We looked at four basic and common renewable, clean and renewable energy types, biomass in general, wind, photovoltaics, and concentrated solar power. On the biomass front, we looked at biopower, which includes a wide variety of bioproducts from forest and mill byproducts, crops, dedicated energy crops, and methane emissions, as well as urban wood waste. And we separated out the dry mill corn ethanol from the as its own separate category. And then we looked at grid, non-grid connected community and utility scale photovoltaics and wind. And then on the concentrated solar power, we looked at community and utility and two different types of systems there, the Stirling and trough and power, Stirling engine and the trough and power tower system. So the criteria that we looked at are the main types of criteria that you need to site renewable energy on any land. And the first one is the most important, and that is the availability and the quality of the renewable energy source, whether it be solar, wind, or biomass. The acreage of the contaminated land, as well as the distance to critical infrastructure like transmission lines and graded roads for access to the property, and the slope and aspect of the property as well. And the next slide, please, slide 31. So the types of lands that we're looking at, these federally tracked lands, contaminated lands, are RCRA, Superfund, federal and non-federal sites, brownfields, and abandoned mine sites as well. And just to give you on the next slide an idea of the numbers of sites that were involved in this, just this screening effort alone, it's in the tens of thousands of sites. But I think what I really wanted to drive home on this slide is that there are thousands of other sites that have not been screened. So the potential is even greater. The number of acres is even greater for being able to site renewable energies on these types of lands. And the next slide, please. 33. So you may ask why use contaminated lands for energy or renewable or clean energy development. It's a productive reuse strategy that provides an economic redevelopment value for otherwise unattractive properties, or what may be more unattractive for your typical redevelopment. Again, as I mentioned earlier, many of these sites are outside of the areas where developers may look at contaminated brownfields, for example, in urban areas. Many of these sites lie outside of that area, so it makes it more more ideal for developing large-scale facilities like wind power and solar power. And many of these sites have institutional controls in place that actually may prohibit any type of other redevelopment, such as housing or commercial types of redevelopment, but may also provide stability to the land, if you will, in terms of it won't be kind of driven out by urban development. And so that there may be longevity associated with that land because the institutional controls are in place. And, you know, just the obvious, you know, using brownfields and contaminated lands rather than greenfields and agricultural land for green energy development seems to make a lot of sense. And it provides a streamlined approach for land acquisition, whether it be long-term lease acquisition of the land or actual purchasing of the land.
Many of these contaminated sites have thousands of acres, which makes it ideal for large-scale energy, renewable energy development, and may make it such that you have to deal with very few parties for acquisition, rather than, say, for example, when Department of Transportation wants to put in a freeway, they have to over private property. There's acquisition that goes on with multiple parties, and that takes a lot of time and effort and money. So we view this as kind of a streamlined approach to land acquisition. And the next slide, just furthering the explanation here of why use contaminated lands. The greenhouse gas reduction benefits of using lands that are already developed, already may have infrastructure in place, power lines, roads, and things of that nature. There's less energy and less cost in many cases required to develop those tracts of land. And, of course, the clean energy production itself has a greenhouse gas benefit in and of itself. And in kind of the high energy demanding world that we live in, during peak hours, of course, using renewable energies can perhaps help mitigate some of the need for these dirtier peak power plants and that we sometimes revert to during those high power periods. And then some of the societal benefits, job creation is can't be underestimated, green collar jobs, as well as energy independence and security. And what I'm going to do next, on the next several slides, is just give you a glimpse into, so slide 35, okay, just a glimpse into some of the results that we have found in this screening exercise. This is an example of the biomass energy generation potential across the country, and just looking at this, you can see that there is pretty significant potential of sites. These are just, again, those federally trash contaminated lands that have met the screening criteria for biomass energy generation. And we have, just to quickly, I don't want to bore you too much because you can look at the screening criteria, the specific screening criteria for biomass in the legend, but it is about 150,000 tons per year or more of bio waste and residues that needs to be present in the area for the site to qualify. For dry mill corn ethanol, it's 100,000 tons per year. And then the distance to transmission lines is 10 miles or less to make it economically feasible. And the property size is 50 acres or more, and for distance to graded roads, it's 50 miles or more. So, and you can see here that all of the sites, all the different types of sites, the abandoned mine sites, the brownfields, RCRAs, federal, non-federal, Superfund sites, actually screened out across the country. And the next slide, I apologize because the title got cut off a little bit, but it's Pennsylvania. I think it got cut off. Yeah, it did. That's unfortunate. This is a state-specific map because we have not only done this across the nation, we have looked at each state individually to see what the total potential is per state. And here you can see that there are a fair number of sites that did qualify for biomass energy generation potential.
Close you are to the resource.
Go look at that. And the next slide, slide 37, is the national map for community wind energy generation potential. And just to speed through those screening criteria,
so
a wind power class of 3 on a scale of 1 to 6, 3 or greater. A property size between, it's quite a large range, 100 acres and just under 2,000 acres. And distance to roads, 25 miles, and the distance to transmission lines was not a criterion for community wind because the assumption is that the infrastructure for community scale wind would be available no matter where you would site it. And again, you can see that a fair number of sites did screen out. And the next slide chose Colorado, and it looks like I think about six of the federally tracked sites screened out, primarily the abandoned mine sites, it looks like, in a federal Superfund site, a couple federal Superfund sites.
Where you can put all the cards.
And just moving on quickly here, the utility scale photovoltaics on the next slide, slide 39. This shows the national picture, of course, most of it being in the southwest region of the country where we have the most solar, concentrated solar energy. And for the photovoltaics, we looked at a solar class of 5 kilowatt hours per meter squared per day, and then the two transmission lines of 10 miles and acres of the property had to be 40 acres or more. And distance to roads is 25 miles or less to be viable. And my apologies for yet the next slide, which is California, and I had to smush it down onto the slide, so it's a California pancake for sure. So apologies for those that are in California. You're pretty flat today. So this is... I was surprised, actually, at how many sites screened out for California and across the range of our federally tracked sites as well. So just to give you an idea of the potential in just one state. And then concentrated solar power is the next and last energy that I will go over. Again, this is even more so in the southwest concentrated. Difference here is just a slightly higher CSP annual solar class of 6, and distance to transmission lines is the same at 10 miles or less. The Stirling engine system requires less land, so it's a smaller threshold for these properties to meet on the acres. Screening criterion of 40, and the trough and power tower systems just require a lot more, and that's why that's at 250 acres or more. And the next slide and final slide on the map is New Mexico, appropriately. Okay, it's coming up. And again, we have a fair number of sites that screened out in New Mexico for CSP. And the next thing I wanted to just go over very quickly are the incentives and give you a preview of one of the incentive sheets that we've pulled together. What we've done is pull together all the state incentives for each state. I've just attached an example here in a couple slides. But I just wanted to... reiterate what many of you probably already know, and that is that there are lots of incentives for renewable energy development at the state level, but also some at the federal level. In addition to our fact sheets, you can also go to the database of state incentives for renewable and energy efficiency, desireusa.org, and you should make sure to type that in very carefully. Otherwise, you might get something else. So the next slide is just an example, and I apologize for the nature of it. This is the front and back of one of the state incentive sheets that we've developed. This is for Connecticut as an example. And you can see that the front side, it really looks at renewable and clean energy incentives at the state level. And the backside, you'll find for each state the development incentive for contaminated lands. So what incentives are out there for developing contaminated lands? And so you can take a look through this on your own. It also lists some just factoids about each state and renewable portfolio standards, when those need to be met, what the current state is of meeting the RPS and things of that nature. Points of contact are also listed for each of these programs, which we thought would be a good thing to include, so ease of just follow up if you're interested in any of these incentives. And last couple slides here, just a few examples. This This is a great project. This is a wind energy generation facility in Lackawanna, New York. It is built atop of a former Superfund site, the Bethlehem Steel Superfund site. You can see it off there in the distance in the photo at the bottom. It is a 20-megawatt energy generation facility. It's enough to power about 7,000 homes, runs on 8 giant wind turbines. The owner of the project, BQ Energy, estimates that the project will expand to 45 megawatts by 2010 with the addition of 10 more of these turbines. And I think in addition to just the reuse of a contaminated land for renewable energy production, the wind turbines themselves are manufactured domestically, not in Lackawanna, but they are manufactured domestically, so job creation is being satisfied in some respects, and local jobs being created as well for maintenance, operation and maintenance of the facility. Okay, and the last slide, slide 46. Just a few projects that are kind of on the table, on the discussion table that may happen. The Summitville Mine and Peru Creek Mine, there's a possible micro-hydro generator being discussed to run the water treatment system for this this contaminated site. And that is a point that I didn't really cover too much in this, but you've heard it in the previous presentations, and that is using the renewable energy to power remediation systems, not just to provide energy for the electric utility grid. And that's another component of the work we're doing here, is trying to integrate that renewable energy generation as well as powering our systems with renewable energies as well. And then there's the Dover landfill. This is in very preliminary discussions at this point, but they are evaluating the development of a solar production farm on a 50-acre portion of the landfill. And there's the Hassayampa landfill in Arizona, where a couple of different options have been explored. Both dealing with bioenergy, the first being either gasification or digestion of agricultural waste that's located in the area for energy generation, as well as large-scale energy generation, as well as to power the groundwater pump and treat and soil vapor systems that run at the site. And another potential project that has been in discussion is a fuel oil production facility using algae as the fuel source, and growing that in an enclosed system for fuel oil production. So that's about it. I encourage folks to ask questions and folks to get involved and to contact me if you have any questions or ideas or potential projects that you have in mind. And my contact information is on the last slide there.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Penny. This is Kathy. I think we have one or two people in the line who aren't muted. I think maybe you're just covering the phone with your hand. So please either push *6 or do mute, okay? We're doing pretty well, but I just wanted to ask you all to double check. Thank you. And also, please feel free to submit questions to me in writing. Go up to the top of your page and push the question mark, and I'll get your question. And we're going to deal with some questions that address Penny's presentation. Thank you very much, Penny. That was very interesting. And some of the ones that are broader, I'm going to wait till the end of the session to ask. Okay, so here's one from Dorothy Allen in Massachusetts DEP, and it says, are any of the mining sites suitable for CO2 sequestration with co-location of coal-fired gasification power plants?
This screening is on a quite high level screening. Hi, Dorothy, by the way. This is a very high level screening. We haven't looked at specific sites for co-location with co-fired gasification plants, but that is certainly something that I think would be worth exploring, and I'd be more than happy to follow up with you on that afterwards if you'd like.
Okay, next question is, could you address EPA's position on the use of anaerobic digesters for generation of biogas for energy production? And before I address this to any of the panelists, we probably cannot address all aspects of EPA's position on this at this panel, but the panelists may be able to speak to it more generally in terms of land reuse policies that we have at the agency. And that question came from Mark Sperlin in Boulder, Colorado.
Hi. So I guess what I would say about that is, in general, we have explored anaerobic digestion as well as gasification on some of these contaminated lands. So, I mean, to the extent that it will provide energy and it makes sense and there are interested parties, I think we are definitely interested in exploring that. I think that
answers. This is Michelle Mahoney. I can actually add to that from the solid waste perspective. Due to EPA's interest in reducing the amount of food waste that's going to landfills, we're very interested in the anaerobic digestion of those materials to produce biogas. And I know Region 9 is looking at that very closely, and it's actually one of the projects that I'll be working more closely with in the next year. So something we're very interested in.
Great. And just to add on, that you sparked another response, and that is for some of the ag waste that's associated with animal operations. That's another way of reducing waste that may go into waterways, and it's a way of getting it out of the environment a little bit better. So it does kind of address the waste reduction in that respect as well.
You like I mentioned, this is Carlos. You might go to EPA's website and look up methane to markets. I think you'll find a lot of information there, of programs and policies, et cetera, that EPA has to foster the reduction of methane emissions and their reuse for energy generation, et cetera.
Okay. Okay, and the next question is, do you foresee or have you seen the requirement for NEPA studies prior to establishing power generation on brownfield-type sites? And this comes from Greg Janik in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Well, I have not actually seen these requirements for NEPA studies. But I think in any specifically related to energy generation on brownfield sites, but I think in keeping with NEPA requirements, it would be something that it wouldn't be outside the realm of NEPA requirements for to look at these types of sites. So, but to talk specifics, I can't really do that at this time.
Thank you, Penny. The next question is, what are some of the barriers to implementation of solar power outside of the Southwest U.S.?
That's a good question. I think, it really depends on the state. So there are certainly some technical barriers, for sure, and that is just the availability and constancy and quality of the solar power, but also there are, incentives that may or may not be offered in a given state. So I think that's another component to look at and may be a barrier, but may also be an opportunity depending on what state. And I think what I would suggest on that front is that you check out our fact sheets for the state incentives.
Thank you, Penny. The next question is from Patrick Madden in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania, and it is, given the low efficiency of corn-based ethanol and its potential impact on food prices, does the EPA tend to de-emphasize it as a green energy option? This is Kathy again. I think that our panelists can talk to the question of our policies for beneficial reuse and our desire to explore renewable energy. But I think some of the broader issues dealing with agency policy on some of these other energy options, I don't know if we have that expertise on this panel.
And just to just follow up a little bit on that, I mean, we're really looking at beneficial reuse of these sites that are contaminated and impaired. So I think, you know, we are open to a wide variety of redevelopment. Energy redevelopment uses. So I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you, Penny. The next question is from Lori Hillebrand in Akron, Ohio, and it is, can you define what the different classes of wind power represent?
Okay, and that's, you know, I thought about including just a graphic on that in the presentation. It is, if you go to NREL, National Renewable Energy Lab's website, they have a graph that shows the different classes of wind, and it's based on how tall your wind turbine is, as well as the wind density. So it varies, and it's not something that's static. But you can get a general idea of what these various wind classes look like. If you just Google NREL and wind power class, it should take you right to information on how to better define these in a general sense.
Thanks, Penny. Questions from Carolyn Monius from New Orleans and Greg Janiak from Pennsylvania, and they're asking if the site screening report on EPA track sites is available and if the incentive sheets are, if they're available as well.
So what we're doing now, this is kind of a preview. We are pulling all of this information together into a report. I hesitate to give a release date, but we anticipate releasing this fairly soon. I would say, you know, within this year, we should release a report that pulls all of this information together. So the maps themselves, the incentive sheets, as well as the limitations, an explanation of the limitations of this data, as well as how it should and shouldn't be used, and the data itself, so that should somebody want to work with the maps a little more, that we will be making that available as well. So I would have to say sometime this year it will come out.
The next question is from Jay Kupaswamy from Savannah, Georgia, and it says, is there any special reason why we refer to these sites as contaminated instead of remediated, which I assume is more appropriate?
Yeah, that's a very good point. It is terminology for sure. There are some sites that are probably going to have some kind of contamination remaining on them just because of the technical impracticability of cleaning up large tracts of land, but there are institutional controls to address that. There, you know, many of these sites are cleaned up. They are maybe what you would call impaired, but yes, we are looking at this wide range of sites that either is or has been contaminated.
Okay, couple more questions. And a question from Doug Malema from Kansas is, what about cost considerations for each of these technologies? Is one technology more economical than the other?
That's a good question. You know, I think it's really going to depend on the site conditions, for sure. If you're in an area of the country, or if your site, for example, is in an area that has great wind power and all the infrastructure is in place or accessible, I think it's really going to, that may make more sense than, you know, a site where you don't have those factors. So I think it's really going to be something you have to address on a site-specific basis. What I will say is that we do have Region 9 is putting out a guide, the Smart Energy Resource Guide, and that should be coming out within the next 2 or 3 months at the latest. And in that guide, and it will be online, I believe it will be on the CLUIN website, as well as the Clean Up Clean Air Region 9 website, and that lays out some of the economic considerations for each of these renewable energy types. So that should be a good resource for you.
Okay, last question for Penny. There are several left over, which I will try to get to at the end, and that is from Region 9. And the question is, if I have private investors willing to put forth money to develop solar farms, what are the first steps I should take to acquire land?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you have the investors, that's a huge step. That's huge. You would have to identify, of course, a piece of land. I didn't see that in the question, but that would be probably the first step, and you would have to really try to identify, well, what the renewable energy type is appropriate at that site. And I think what's really important here is also coordinating well with the local stakeholders. So the city official redevelopment authorities, or local redevelopment authorities, as well as any other parties that are involved in any type of cleanup, whether it be the state or local authorities. So I think that's another critical step that needs to be taken, so that everybody's on the same page and everybody is in agreement on the path forward.
If I could just add one plug after that. In early May is the Brownfields 2008 conference, and my understanding is they have over 1,000 pieces of property of contaminated or previously contaminated properties that are available for reuse. So if you were to be looking to identify a piece of land, that might be one resource.
And I will plug one other thing. There are several sessions that address green at the Brownfields Conference that address green remediation and revitalization and redevelopment of brownfield sites, and we will be holding a session as that focuses just on this, citing renewable energies on contaminated lands, and you can check out the Brownfields website for more info.
Thank you, Penny. We're going to go to our final speaker for today, and that's Michelle Mahoney, and she's from our Office of Solid Waste, but is currently working with our Superfund program, and the title of her presentation is Reuse of Damaged Lands with Soil Amendments. Michelle?
Thanks, Kathy. Like Kathy mentioned, my home office is Office of Solid Waste, and I've been working in Superfund for the last year, and I'm really excited to be on this project because my work in the Solid Waste program was all about getting organic materials out of the waste stream and creating compost, and one of our challenges was trying to find markets for this compost and why should we separate our waste. And this project really, and also with the industrial, some of my colleagues work on industrial materials like the coal combustion products and foundry sands and C&D debris, and that totally ties into this as the end use for some of these materials that I can take back to my office and solid waste and bring the two programs together. So it's been a really good experience for me. As far as my presentation today, I'm going to give you a little bit of technical background on soil amendments and why it's a good idea to use them and why they work, and then talk a little bit about a current project that I've been working on under Kathy Allen's larger group on the climate change and contaminated lands work group. Of which I am a co-lead with Harry Compton, who's been in the agency for many years and is really an expert in this type of application of soil amendments. And then I'll present to you a couple tools that we have available for those of you who are interested in learning about how to do ecological land reuse at your site.
and where you can get more, where you can get help with some of your efforts. So if we move to the next slide, slide 49, I just have listed here some of the, like, what we consider to be damaged lands. And these would be, and these are the types of sites where we would want to use soil amendments. These are your hard rock mining sites, and this is where minerals are extracted from rock hosts. And these sites can be open pit or underground operations. These are your coal mining sites, your sand and gravel mining sites, smelting and refining sites, which are facilities where ores and fuels are processed. And then we have construction sites, which are very common, and mixed contaminant sites, which include our brownfield sites. And a lot of the problems associated with these operations can be treated with soil amendments. And in order to reduce the exposure of the contaminants and limit exposure of pathways by immobilizing the contaminants. The next slide, slide 50. Some of the issues that occur in the soils as a result of our operation on these sites. Toxicity from metals, which can be harmful to plants and soil organisms. The pH could end up being too high or too low. When the pH is too low, soil metals can go into a solution. When it's too high, our oxyanions, like arsenate, can go into solution. There's sodicity problems, which is excess sodium in the soil, which causes plant toxicity, can degrade the soil structure and disperse the soil, which in turn will limit root growth, aeration, and water infiltration. Salinity, which is a buildup of sulfates and chlorides that can also limit plant growth. And then we also can have undesirable soil physical properties, such as density and poor soil aggregation, which leads to reduced water infiltration and water holding capacity, and therefore it's very difficult to revegetate under these conditions. And then also nutrient deficiencies, because we're mining everything from these sites, and that just leads to lower soil fertility. On the next slide, slide 51. So why should we repair these soils? The obvious reason is to mitigate the exposure to contaminants. And the use of appropriate soil amendments for your contaminants can chemically precipitate metals and reduce their availability to plants and leaching into groundwater. And then also by repairing the soil, we will activate the plant growth by restoring soil health and just making the site more ecologically viable for plants. And then by introducing the plant growth, we will solve some of our erosion problems and sediment losses. And then in some cases, you can even use some plants to help phytoremediate the site, but you still have to fill the soil in order to get the plants to grow. The next slide. So why should we use soil amendments? Some of the reasons to use them to solve some of these problems, like I mentioned, we reduce the contaminant bioavailability and the phytoavailability. We improve the soil health and the ecosystem function. And I want to point everyone to a document that came out late last year that's entitled The Use of Soil Amendments for Remediation, Revitalization, and Reuse. And in that document, there's a table on page 5 which lists all the types of problems that could exist that can be addressed by the use of soil amendments. And it'll list your heavy metal concentration and give you some ideas of what type of amendments you should be looking at to help improve the soil at your site. So I highly recommend anyone working on these types of projects to take a look at that. On the next slide, I just provide some examples of the types of soil amendments that are out there. There's plenty of organic amendments, and some of them are pretty obvious as to what they are. Biosolids are from our wastewater treatment facilities, manures, compost. Digestates is referring to organic waste that are left over from anaerobic digestion processes. This can occur with municipal biosolids. There's pulp sludges, yard and wood trimmings, and then ethanol production byproducts, which is a new type of soil amendments based on new technologies, and there's actually not a lot of information out there on using those byproducts as soil amendments, but I'm sure that will come with time. And then in the middle column lists some products that can be used for changing pH of the site. And then the last column are some mineral type of soil amendments to help build soil structure. And again, the document on the use of soil amendments has a table in there, table 3 on page 18, which lists all of these amendments individually along with their availability, costs, and the advantages and disadvantages of using each of them. So if you're going to consider using one of these, you'll find all that information there along with links to further information.
It's a nice idea, though, that, you know, you can...
On the next slide, so if you're going to use a soil amendment, you're obviously going to want to know how much you want to apply, and this is going to depend on what the concern is at your site. Some of the approaches you can use is measuring the total amount of organic matter at your site and compare that to maybe an adjacent site at the organic matter there and applying a rate that's a little bit more than the natural organic matter because when you first apply these materials, you will lose a lot of carbon in the initial degradation. You can also look at sites where amendments have been used that had a similar problem to your site, and you could possibly use the same rate that they used at that site. There are some laboratory procedures and measurements that you can do to determine how much of an amendment you need to add. And then you can also use a qualitative decision, and that's generally used when the only thing you're trying to do is build soil organic matter. You're not worried about any contaminants on the site. The other thing you want to be concerned about with application rates is some states have permitting and regulations, and they do that in order to protect against excessive nitrogen leaching. So you do want to check to see if your state has any leaching. The next slide just presents some logistics that you'll have to think about in using soil amendments at your site. The availability of the amendment that you want to use, how far away is it? A lot of these amendments are available everywhere, particularly biosolids. You can check with your POCWs, you can find animal feeding operations if you want to use manures, look for coal-fired power plants. Depending on what the amendment is, you can find the source where it's coming from and see what its availability is in conjunction to where you are. And the reason being because transportation is going to be one of your largest costs in doing remediating a site with soil amendments, because you could be talking about large volumes of material and you don't want to be trucking it too far if you're concerned about keeping costs down, and then also the greenhouse gas emissions associated with transportation. You want to think about if you're going to need to store any of these materials on your site, the proper storage for them. Also, how are you going to apply it? Are you going to be blending any of the materials? Sometimes you want to blend the biosolid with the foundry sand to change the soil texture. And then also public concern. It's very important to involve the community in the decision-making process for the site because the public will be concerned about odors and toxicity. If you're adding another, you're basically using a waste. They might see it as a waste being used to clean up a contaminated site, but just adding contamination on top of contamination. A lot of public education is really important when you're going to do something like this. And then also cost, which is going to vary depending on what you're trying to do. Our paper on soil amendments has some case studies in it where the cost ranges from $1,000 per acre to up to $100,000 per acre, and that's all going to depend on where your soil amendment is, how much you're going to need to use, and what the extent of your contamination is. On the next slide, after you build your soil, you're going to want to revegetate your amended soil, and you want to think about your plant selection. Do you want to use seeds or do you want to use seedling? And I think this is going to depend on where your site is and what the slopes are and how accessible it is. And you want to look at putting things in there that are ecologically diverse and have a long-term sustainability. So we generally recommend using native and non-invasive species as a plant selection. And also you need to be concerned if you're going to need to irrigate. How are you going to do that? And then also implement a monitoring plan to try and control invasive and weed species and manage wildlife. So the next slide, I want to talk to you about terrestrial carbon sequestration, which is something we're looking at as a result of using soil amendments at some of the Superfund and abandoned mine land sites. It's been done for many decades now, and there's a lot of talk about we're adding all this carbon to carbon-poor soils. Is there potential that there's carbon sequestration going on from both the addition of the material and then the ecological plant community that's coming in, and how do we measure that, and how much is it? Is it really significant? And I just want to talk a little bit about terrestrial carbon sequestration and mention that it's very highly related to your soil management practices. If you have a lot of erosion and you're tilling your site, you're going to be losing a lot of carbon. That's why at these sites where we are adding amendments, we're generally not disturbing the site after it's done. So there is the potential that the carbon is being sequestered there for long periods of time. Soil amendments build soil organic carbon, which stimulate plant growth. And if you have plants there, that's another way to decrease your soil disturbance. We're also looking at the carbon sequestration to see if it might create an incentive for remediating large isolated properties if people see that there's a carbon sequestration benefit. And, of course, it's going to benefit the environment if we can sequester carbon in this way. So what we're doing, if you go to the next slide, we have a carbon sequestration project. This is the project that I mentioned in the beginning that I'm co-lead with, Harry Thompson. And we're reviewing the current state of knowledge on the use of soil amendments and establishing plant growth and what the effects are on carbon sequestration. What have people already been measured? What do people already know? And we at EPA are working on developing a protocol for measuring carbon sequestration at our sites where we are using amendments. And we plan on having a long-term research plan so we can know, maybe you get a like huge carbon burst in the beginning, but how long does it last, and just trying to work out all those types of issues. So we will be doing some field research at those sites, which we're still identifying at this point. So I just want to go over on the next slide some benefits of revitalizing damaged land. You're going to improve your water quality. You can create wildlife habitat. Reuse devoid land. Increase your property value. Reduce erosion. And then the potential for sequestering carbon. These are all great reasons everyone should be doing this. And then on the next slide, just the benefits of why using soil amendments.
We're on slide 16.
Using soil amendments to revitalize damaged land. Because it has been proven to decrease the bioavailability of toxic pollutants, so you don't necessarily have to dig and haul all the material. And then it also reuses materials that might end up going to a landfill or being incinerated. It just closes that cycle of our industrial processes. It restores soil health and ecological function, and it can reduce your costs compared with other treatment options. So in the next slide, I just want to present to you a web-based tool that has been developed in the last 6 months or so that's called EcoTools. And on this site, we basically described all the principles of ecologically reusing land, the importance of building soil health, and some links for plants and vegetation. And then if you look... I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4. It's like the fifth tab on the left. There's an Act Locally button that you can click on. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see what comes up. And it's the traditional map of EPA that comes up on a lot of our websites. And you can search, you can click on region by region to get state-specific help for your sites. There's a lot of federal agencies that are doing ecological type of land reuse that have resources where they'd be willing to help you with your sites. So we're trying to compile as much of that information as we find into this one area. It's kind of a resource telephone internet guide, if you will. So anybody who goes there and you say, hey, I do this and I can help and you want your name or you know somebody's information, it's
should be on there, please contact me and let me know. We'd love to add it. And the other thing I'll mention that we're probably in the next week or so, we're going to add a page to this website that is going to be a feedback form where you can provide us with questions if you need site-specific help. We're going to offer ourselves up as resources to help you with your site work. Or if you have questions or ideas for more fact sheets, we're going to have that up there and hope to get some feedback from you all. The next slide I just want to show you is something that was done by my colleague Ellen Rubin here in the program. It's called the Technical Performance Measures Matrix, and this is an internet-based tool that you can use to determine whether or not your SOL amendments are functioning as you had designed them, so that you can prove that you're reducing risk to human health and the environment. And this is part of our whole effort to look at the long-term sustainability of some of our projects. And just on the next slide, I just list a couple more resources. I know I had mentioned one of them as an answer to someone's question about invasive species. There are a few fact sheets that were created based on questions that were coming from some of the Superfund project managers about ecological reuse, and I've just listed them here with their links so you can read them at your leisure and hopefully learn something from them. And let us know if there's other questions you have, because we're certainly willing to make more fact sheets. And then the last slide, I just provide my contact information along with my colleague Ellen Rubin. We'd love to hear feedback. If you have any ideas or questions related to this topic, please let us know. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Michelle. We're going to go through our final set of questions now, and I don't think I'll be able to get through everybody, but we'll get through a lot of them. The first question is from Jason Chan from Bohemia, New York. And the question is, are there damaged lands that can be considered beyond repair where soil amendments may not be effective? Sorry, I lost my page. If so, how would you determine if a site is beyond repair or not?
This is Michelle. Like I said, I've only been in the Superfund program for the last year. I've never heard of a site that's been beyond repair. Maybe I'll open that up to the other panel members that have been working in the program longer.
This is Penny McDaniel. There are some circumstances where contamination, I think I referred to this very briefly in my presentation, sites may be, maybe technologically impracticable to remediate a site, maybe just due to its sheer size. And that is to completely eliminate the traces of contamination. And, when we go and remediate a site, we're looking at cleaning up the site as much as technically practicable and eliminating any exposure to human health and ecological systems. So if there is a circumstance where contamination may be left in place, for example, that's usually followed by some kind of technical impracticability, institutional control to limit perhaps the use of the land. I referred to that a little bit earlier. That's mostly on the Superfund side.
And another point, I assume the question is in referring to soil amendments. And again, ultimately, the purpose of the remedies is to protect human health and the environment. And I think the question refers to recovery, if it's possible to recover the site. Ultimately, what we want to do is prevent that risk of exposure. So if, for example, scarred mine lands, the risk is acid mine drainage, maybe we can implement some physical barriers or something else to prevent that damage. But in that case, it may be a situation where soil amendments would not allow you to recover the the functional soil profile, but we could still prevent the waste from the site leaving it.
Thank you. The next question is from Robert Strauss from Wisconsin DNR, and he asks, please define CCPs for soil amendments.
Sure, and sorry about that on my slide. I always hesitate putting acronyms on there, but it's coal combustion products. I think it's obvious the reason I abbreviated it because it's so long, but it's just the byproduct from coal-fired power plants.
you. This is a question from Tom Potter at Massachusetts DEP, and the question is, does burying large amounts of organic material lead to anaerobic environment at depth that may lead to methane production that has a greater greenhouse potential than CO2?
Yes. I think the simple answer to that is, organic material left to go anaerobic produces methane. And if you apply the material, if it's, feasible to do that to land, you're exposing it to oxygen, you'll get anaerobic digestion, or aerobic digestion as opposed to anaerobic, and therefore you won't get the methane emission.
Okay. Here's a, could you explain carbon sequestration?
Sure. I guess in the
slide 58.
In the, Carlos, sorry, I have to say, Carlos just handed me the definition of carbon sequestration in, I assume this is a green remediation primer. It's the removal from the emission stream of CO2 other greenhouse gases that would otherwise be emitted to the atmosphere. And in the sense that what I'm talking about is terrestrial carbon sequestration, which is taking that CO2 and having it stored in the soil, microbial life, and plant community as part of their biomass. So, and that's why I was saying it's very important that these sites do not get disturbed, because if you disturb that, you release that CO2 that's being sequestered by their biomass. But there are certainly other ways that people are looking at sequestering carbon, like geologic injections and things like that. That's not what I'm referring to in this case.
The next question is from Sherlyn Camaro from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and she's asking about a site that was active from 62 to 68 that was a sanitary landfill, and that the landfill has been generating leachate, and she was wondering if this type of site could be considered, and if yes, what could be used? So I think the question is, could it be considered for soil amendments?
Yes.
I think we may need to have more.
Yeah, I think we might need more information.
You may
want to
contact Michelle.
Yeah, please contact me directly and we can talk about it. I'm not sure if your question is whether soil amendments will help remediate the leachate. I think the answer to that would be no. It's not really clear to me exactly what the question is.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a few more questions. We're getting close to the end. There were a number of questions related to various sorts of bioremediation or specific sites that I'm not going to bring up here, but you have the contact information in the website. And I think that some of the following questions that we have left could be addressed to all of the panelists. They're kind of cross-cutting. And I also just want to remind everybody that at this time they can also submit topics for future seminars as well. Okay, so one of the questions that's asked is from Phil Sandine from Princeton, New Jersey. And it says, the discussion so far has not mentioned directly the use of life cycle analysis to determine the complete environmental footprint of a remedial action. And a generally accepted description of LCA is that an objective process to evaluate the environmental impact associated with the activity. I'm not going to read the whole part here, but it talks about life cycle analysis. And therefore, it says, therefore, should not a green remediation be conducted only after an LCA, life cycle analysis, has determined that the remedial action will have less of an impact on human health than, for example, a passive remedial action such as natural attenuation? I'll turn that over to panelists. Part of the question is, do you use life cycle analysis, and the other question is the selection.
I think that's a good question, and certainly life cycle analysis is a very useful tool. We didn't touch on that during this discussion, but going back to one of the original definitions I had, sustainable approaches to revitalization is a holistic approach that considers the broad array of environmental factors and community impacts during all phases in order to maximize environmental, social, and economic benefits. And it's difficult for you to know what those are unless you've done some type of life cycle analysis to actually identify what the benefits are. So I would say,
we are definitely encouraging that when you're looking at a site, if you're looking at different options, you certainly want to be able to identify what impacts and the variety of costs are for those.
This is Kathy. I just would like to mention that earlier someone talked about a Region 3 pilot that's looking at remedy selection issues, and they are piloting methods that might be applied from life cycle analysis. Carlos?
So that project we talked about, we mentioned in Region 3, is a RCRA corrective action program site. And then the question refers to, I understand, refers to remedy selection. So it's looking at what a holistic look at the environmental benefits and impacts of a remedy and selecting the one that has the lowest cost. And I mean, that I wouldn't disagree with that. What we are looking at, though, here in looking at green remediation, particularly in the Superfund program, is that there's no doubt that we will continue to select the remedies that we're currently selecting because often they offer the only or they offer the best alternative to protecting human health and the environment, and that there are some negative impacts from any technology that we use. In our approach, looking at green remediation, is across the board, at all the suite of technologies that we are currently using, where are the opportunities to minimize their impact during implementation?
All right, then I'll go to the last question, and with the last question, I'm going to direct it to Sarah Rasmussen and then turn the session over to her to close it. But before I do the last question, I would like to thank Penny and Carlos and Michelle for their great work that they've been doing here and for sharing what they've been doing with all of us today. And with that, I'm going to direct this question from Amy Lawrence in East Syracuse, New York. And it said, as mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, sustainability involves striking a balance between economic, environmental, and social considerations. And we've been focusing on green remediation on the environmental footprint. And so it says, we seem to be missing the social component of sustainability. Should green remediation be named sustainable remediation to include social considerations? And should policy be developed to address social considerations as well as environmental considerations?
That brings it up an interesting point, which is the differentiation between sustainable and green. For the most part, our green approaches are referring to what the impacts are on human health and the environment and working to minimize our impacts, looking at the wide variety of media and receptors that are going on, but still focusing on human health and the environment. Sustainable, as mentioned in the first part of this session, also incorporates economic and social impacts. I don't see us creating guidance at this point. I'm not aware that we're working to create guidance, and I don't really want to speak to the question of whether guidance should be created, but I do think it's good to acknowledge that there are those differences, and I also believe, if you go back and look at that diagram, there are times when you can find win-win-win situations. If you are just even aware of the economic and social implications, you may be able to find an approach which actually achieves all the goals.
Well, with that, I'm going to close the question and answer session because we're almost done, and I know Sarah just wants to wrap up with a couple of things. Slide 66.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you again, this is a great time to submit what topics you'd like to see in future sessions and future seminars, which of the many programs going on, or if you have an interesting project you think would be useful for us to be presenting. I'd also like to ask you to fill out your feedback forms. These are very helpful to us in understanding whether we should be doing more sessions or not, and how we can gear them. So I'd like to thank you all in advance for filling out your feedback forms. It's very easy. You can just click on them on slide 67. I also want to again go back and thank the panelists and to again mention that Carlos's Green Remediation Primer, which is a fabulous document, has just been posted. That was one of the items that we kind of done in conjunction with this session. And I would like to bring to your attention the back few pages, which is probably the most comprehensive list of references you're going to find right now. It's a fabulous reference. So please go and look at that. In addition, we've had many other references listed here. Do check back with our website. We'll be updating them. And with that, I think I would like to say thank you for attending the session, and I hope everybody has a good last part of their Earth Day.